Coast 89.7 is proud to present the latest edition of our radio documentary series produced with the financial support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. And now, The Story of Home, with your host, Donnie Antle.
Welcome to The Story of Home. I'm Donnie Antle. In this episode, we visit Whitney Pier and meet some of the people who can claim to be from the Pier Deer. The importance of coal to Cape Breton's story cannot be overstated. The rich coal fields ringing Sydney Harbour brought a measure of prosperity to the island, and it was coal that would fire the furnace of steel production at the turn of the 20th century. An American industrialist named Henry Melville Whitney would build the largest integrated steel plant in the British Empire on the southern side of the harbor. In its shadow, a neighborhood grew that would bear Whitney's name. The new steel plant attracted people from places such as Eastern Europe, Poland, the Middle East, and the West Indies, looking for a new start in a new land. Dr. Tom Urbaniak is a political science professor at CBU and is quite active in the Polish community of Whitney Pier.
The prospect of employment in the coal mines and the steel plant was a major factor. Also, the political situation in Poland in the 19th century, early 20th century. It's important to remember that in 1795, Poland disappeared from the map. It was partitioned among its neighbors, Russia, Prussia at the time, Austria at the time. And so the country was under occupation. And in many regions of Poland, that meant poverty and oppression. And so many people were eager to find opportunities, as dangerous and difficult as those opportunities were. And certainly they were dangerous and difficult for the early arrivals to Cape Breton.
Father Roman Duvsinovsky is the pastor at the Holy Ghost Ukrainian Catholic Church.
You have to appreciate that the first immigrants from Ukraine were farmers, and they came here because Canada was offering free land for homesteading out west. And in Ukraine, there was no opportunity to own land. There were most of them that did farm were tenant farmers, and everyone was eager for security to have their own land. And then when Canada made this offer, hordes of them came over. They didn't get the best lands, but they were expected to clear the land, build a home on it, and work the land, but the land was given to them for free. So when they arrived at Pier 21, they had agents both from the coal company and from the steel mill looking for workers, and they would tell them stories of why would you want to get on the train for 3 days, 4 nights, and to be put off in the middle of nowhere. We have homes for you. We have work for you. We have guaranteed income for you. Well, why would you put yourself at risk? And the first ones who came to Cape Breton came very hesitantly because they didn't know if the promises would be kept. And when they saw that they were kept, that there was work, that there were homes ready for them to occupy, they wrote back home. And then the second wave that came with the intention already of coming to Sydney to work.
Deacon Whitfield Best is the warden of St. Philip's African Orthodox Church on Hankard Street.
You know, I can speak on the questions that I asked my father. And he was telling me, he said, he came there for a better way of living. So I said, what do you mean a better way of living? I said, you came from a nice warm country and you're coming over here to a cold country that you know nothing about. He said, economics. You know, he said, like in Barbados, he said, like, I used to get up early in the morning, We had to be in the fields around 6 o'clock in the morning. And he said, then you work from 6 o'clock, say sun up until sundown, from 6 to 6. And he said, it was hard, hot work. And the pay was very little. You end up with about maybe a shilling or two a day, like, you know. So he said that was no, he said, I didn't like that kind of life. It was no life for me. So he said, when the steel plant opened up, you know, and they were asking for people to come, men to come, he said, I heard of the opportunity, so I came over. At that time, I think he said he was around 15 years old or something when he came over, and he was all alone. He came on his own. Nobody, he knew nobody here, and he just came on his own, which was quite an adventure for a young boy, you know. But that's why he said, that's why most of us came over here, for opportunities, you know, for a better way of life.
Father Albert Maroon is a retired priest and is active in the Lebanese community.
They came shortly before the end of the 18th century, as the 19th century, around the late 1800s. And I think they came originally over to North Sydney, and there were some that went to New Glasgow area. As my grandfather came over there, and then they moved to Dominion and Victoria Mines, and then they came to Sydney. The small group came over early, and then the larger group came over when the steel plant was established here in Sydney. I suppose they worked at the one over in the north side, and then they came to Sydney, which was the bigger plant. And that was the majority of them came here to Sydney. So there was large groups, and they were from northern and southern Lebanon. They weren't from Beirut. They were from small villages, small towns, really, really small places, poor places. And there was strife over there at that time, because the Turks were still dominant over in that area. You know, the Turks were a powerful country at that time. And so there was not much law in Lebanon. You know, it was my father and his friend, one of the Abbas fellows who was a barber here, Leo Abbas, used to patrol the village with a revolver to protect the people from raids, from, you know, people that around the area could raid the you know, that little town. But they had to have protection. So they were glad to get out, you know. Thank you.
All of these desperate groups came to work in the plant, or in the pit. They made their home in the new neighborhood of Whitney Pier. For these new Cape Bretoners, it was the rhythm of the mill that their lives moved to. These new arrivals would be given the most dangerous tasks.
They would send all the immigrants down into the pit, while all the but all the people of influence would have the office jobs. So there was this separation between the office administration and those in the pit, and in the coal covens as well. All the dirty work was given to the immigrants, while the clean work, the office work, predominantly was handled by the Anglo-Saxon.
In the days before regulations and safety protocols, it fell on the community to take care of itself.
In the early years, the jobs in the steel plant that were given to the immigrants were often the most dangerous jobs. And that was one of the strong motivations for the formation of the St. Michael's Polish Benefit Society in 1909. There was no social safety net at the time. There was no workers' compensation. Some of these workers were losing limbs. Some of them were dying in the plant, and there was no support to take care of their families. And so the societies pooled some resources and said, you know, we have to provide a basic standard of decency here. We sometimes sort of, as we should, celebrate the achievements and the resiliency of these people, but the horrible and occasionally nightmarish conditions of their labor should not be forgotten as well.
This was before my time. I arrived 18 years ago, already when the steel mill was closing and they were beginning to demolish it. But they said that Whitney Pier attracted people from Sydney. People would come from Sydney to do their shopping in the pier. The pier had two cinemas on Victoria Avenue. So it was a humming community, thriving community, a very close-knit community, and one, from what I gather, because of the need for trust, you put your hands in your co-workers, you put your life in your co-workers' hands when you went to work, that there was a very close, between the different ethnic groups, a very close tie. So it was a very well-knit community here.
They all got along very well down there because they were all in the same situation, the dangerous situation of the steel plant. It was dangerous to work there. And so there was a sense of camaraderie amongst all the people that worked over there. They get along very well together.
As the population of the pier swelled, opportunities for the entrepreneurially minded soon presented themselves. As Deacon Best explains, many of the people in the community brought skills with them that could be applied outside of the steel plant.
Most of the men, when they came from the West Indies, they had a trade. Like, you know, some were carpenters, some were painters, some were plumbers, electricians, shoemakers. I know we had a shoemaker down here, Sir Evans, he also worked at the steel plant. But he was a shoemaker. And he always used to say, because we used to live next to him, and sometimes I'd go in there because I like the smell of leather, and I'd go in there and he'd be working on a shoe. So I said, "Can you make shoes?" He said, "Oh yes, we were taught that. In order to pass your trade in the West Indies, said you had to be able to make shoes, you know, make them from just plain leather like this, you know." And he showed me a pair of our leggings what he made, because he always liked to be in the Mounties, And he used to wear the breeches and the leather, the hard leather things, you know, you come up there. And he showed me what he made, it was quite impressive. He was when he finished putting, resoling your shoe, it looked like it was brand new, you know, because he took that much pride in what he was doing. And he'll buff it out and blend things in. It was really good, you know. But most of them came with trades. As I said, some were carpenters, electricians, plumbers, you know, gardeners. They all came when they had a trade, when they came.
And one thing about the people that came over, they were aggressive and smart enough to break away from what they had there. They weren't content with the poverty and with the threat of war and that sort of stuff. So they were aggressive people. And so when they came over here, they wanted to work. And they became successful because they were good workers. They'll take any kind of a job just to make money. And then they would set up a little business like my father did in the front of this building. He worked a little bit at the railroad and then at the steel plant. And then he opened a business actually on the corner of George and Townsend. And when he got married, he bought this house, which was a smaller peak roof house. And as the family grew, and we ended up 14 here, he extended the house and so on, and the business. And he was quite successful.
Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe also made their way to the pier. Some worked in the plant or in the pit, but most came to establish the businesses that lined Victoria Road. Martin Chernin is a local businessman and entrepreneur, and has served as the president of the Temple Sons of Israel for over three decades.
My grandparents, the Chernins and the Goms, came over in early 1900s, 1903, 4, something around there, okay. From Russia.
And what
both sides.
And both sides of that. And they came from Russia?
They came from Russia, yes.
Okay. And what brought them to Cape Breton?
I think the pogroms and everything and the anti-Semitism in Russia, and they decided they wanted to get out of there. Well, they still could. And that they looked at coming to Canada. Big demand there. There were some Jewish families here already, which they knew of, and I think the coal and steel industry drew them over because it was pretty industrious in those days.
Okay. And would they have worked in when they first arrived, would they have worked in the mines or in the plant?
My grandparents didn't work in the mines or the plant. My grandfather, Gom, was a tailor in Russia, and he came over and worked in a tailor shop and then set up his own clothing store and tailor shop in Whitney Pier. And I think he also had a tailor shop in Western Newfoundland at one time. And he brought over 8 brothers and 3 sisters to Cape Breton, or out of Russia. Most of them Cape Breton, some went to Detroit. A few of his brothers went to Detroit, I think, and the rest stayed here. My grandfather Chernin came over, and he started a little corner grocery store, which eventually grew into L.H. Chernin & Sons Limited Wholesale. And then my father served overseas, and after the war he came back and went into business along with his 2 brothers, and that expanded to grocery stores in Cape Breton and Western Newfoundland retail, and on it goes from there.
Martin is related to the Gom family, who were well known in the pier.
Well, they're professionals too. On my mother's side, there was the Gom Clinic in the pier. I think Dr. Abe Gom and Dr. David Gom, and their clinic, I think there was 6 or 7 doctors worked besides them at the clinic. I think at one time they were the biggest clinic in Atlantic Canada. And in those days it was like a walk-in clinic, there's no appointments. And also in those days they did house calls, pretty well everything. And they had their youngest brother, my uncle Dr. Cyril Gong, became a dentist, and he moved on to Boston. He was one of the fathers of endodontics, and he was actually the dean of Tufts for a while, where they taught it. And then, of course, Uncle Pinky Gom got involved in politics, and he was the first Jewish member and cabinet minister in the province of Nova Scotia under Robert Stanfield. And my mother, of course, was a Gom, Dr. Abe's sister. And her sisters, Aunt Bessie, was married to Dr. Harold Davidson, who was iron no throat specialist in Sydney. And one of my father's brothers became a dentist, and he moved to Toronto. Actually, he went from Glace Bay to Stephenville, Newfoundland, and after that he moved to Toronto in dentistry. And my other two uncles, Meyer and Joey, stayed in the grocery business with my father.
The pier grew organically into smaller neighborhoods divided not just along ethnic lines, but also along divisions of the workload at the steel plant. Father Roman explains the divide within the Ukrainian community.
The pier was divided into two areas. You had on one side of Victoria Avenue, on our side of Victoria Avenue, in the west of Victoria, it was called Koksonia, because Koksonia referred to the coke ovens. Everybody who lived on this side worked at the coke ovens. Everybody who lived on the other side of Victoria Avenue worked in the steel mill. Now it's called Colonia. So the colony and the Koksonia, even within the Ukrainian community, there was the sort of division by work location.
It's interesting that the memories of geographical placement are still strong. There was even a political boundary, Ward 5, Ward 6 in the pier. And so most of the Polish immigrants and their descendants lived in Ward 5, along with most of the African Nova Scotian residents, and indeed members of many other ethnic communities. The highest density was in that community of Ward 5. That was a deeply multicultural political boundary, if you will. And so those communities quickly gained the experience of working together and sharing each other's traditions, and in fact defining new traditions.
Even as the steel plant workers relied on each other to keep each other safe while they worked, there were still tensions within the community that occasionally reared their ugly heads. The West Indian and African community settled in the very shadow of the plant, in a neighborhood bordered by Hankard Street to the north and Tupper Street to the south. As Deacon Best explains, anyone from that enclave who strayed outside of those boundaries after sunset faced danger.
There was a gang here. My father called it Scotty and his gang. Now, they would come down on different occasions. They would come down, and he said, if after sunset, if a black man entered, past Hanker Street, he'd get beat up. They'd beat him up. They had gangs, they'd beat him up. And they'd, he'd have to come back. He said the only time they could, after more West Indians came over here and they got in bigger groups, he said then if any one of them wanted to go up the pier after 6 o'clock, they'd go up in a group. This way they wouldn't be attacked, So I guess it wasn't easy for them.
Shake, 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 Sinora, shake your body liner. Shake, 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 Sinora, shake it all the time. Work, 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 Sinora, work your body liner. Work, 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 Sinora, work it all the time. My girl's name is Sonora, I tell you friends I adore her. And when she dances, oh brother, she's a hurricane in all kinds of weather. Jump in the line, rock your body on time. Okay, I believe you, jump in the line, rock your body on time. Okay, I believe you, jump in the line, rock your body on time. Okay, I believe you, jump in the line, rock your body on time. Shake, 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 Sinora, shake your body line. Whoop. Shake, 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 Sinora, shake it all the time. Work, 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 Sinora, work your body line. Work, 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 Sinora, work it all the time. You can talk about cha-cha, tango, waltz, or the rumba. Sinora's dance has no title. You jump in the saddle, hold on to the bridle. Jump in the line, rock your body on time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body. Rock your body, child. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Somebody help me. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Whoop. Shake, 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 Sinora, shake your body line. Shake, 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 Sinora, shake it all the time. Work, 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 Sinora, work shake your body line. Yeah. Work, 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 Senora, work it all the time. Senora, she's a sensation, the reason for aviation. And fellas, you got to watch it. When she wind up, she bottom, she go like a rocket. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Heist those skirts a little higher. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Off the chimney. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Shake, 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 Senora. Shake your body line. Work, 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 Senora. Work it all the time. Dance, 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 Senora. Dance it all the time. Work, 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 Senora. Work it all the time. Senora dances calypso. Left to right is the tempo. And when she gets the sensation, she go up in the air, come down in slow motion. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Somebody help me. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Okay, I believe you. Jump in the line, rock your body in time. Shake, 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 Senora. Shake your body line. Shake, 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 Senora. Shake it all the time. Work, 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 Senora.
These dark episodes of intolerance were, thankfully, the exception rather than the rule in the pier. The people of the pier soon established community groups and halls where they could gather for social occasions.
So at the corner of Galicia Street and Wesley Street in 1911 was the first hall of the St. Michael's Polish Benefit Society. The society had been established in 1909. It's still running, so it's marking its 110th anniversary this year with a series of public activities. And it's the oldest continuously operating Polish society in Canada. So 1909 it was founded. By 1911, the members, through volunteer labor, had already constructed a hall at that particular street corner. And of course, that was replaced in 1949 by the current Polish Village Hall, which is still owned by the society.
Where the parking lot is behind the church, that's where the first Ukrainian hall was. There was a joint hall on Wesley and Galicia Street, now called Galicia, and it was a joint hall with the Polish community. So both the Poles and the Ukrainians built a joint hall together, and then they built their separate buildings. And the first hall was it was a wooden structure, one story, basically a fire trap with only one door going in. And then they built the church. And then in 1932, this church was built, and in 1962, the hall was built.
Well, I think that the people that first came over saw a need of having, you know, a community, a place where they could come and meet and entertain themselves and have the Lebanese food and so on. We had a really strong group of people that lived around the area where the Cedars Club is now, and they built a hall there, and it didn't have much of the facilities, you know, no running water. They had to run lines over to my grandfather's house to supply, you know, water when they had a party and so on. And I don't even remember a bathroom being there. They would use the local people's bathrooms, you know, for the parties and so on. And then in around 1955, they tore that building down and built the Cedars Club, which was a one-story building, and it didn't have the wings on it, you know, the first-story wings that go off the side. So that was built then, and then through the years they expanded, they put the wings on. One side was the kitchen area, the other side was the, we call it the bar side. And then they got a grant one time to replace the roof, and so I asked them if they would build a second story in that central area. So they did, and now that's rented out to different companies, whatever. And so that's been going pretty strong since 1955.
Taking part in each other's traditions made Whitney Pier a true melting pot. Recreation during the off hours from the plant crossed ethnic lines. As an example, look no further than a card game brought by the Lebanese immigrants that soon became a staple of many a Cape Breton gathering. That game, of course, is Tarbish.
I have it, you know, from many different sources that it was the Lebanese that brought it over. And as a matter of fact, right now, the people in Halifax who brought a game, something like Tarbish, over with them. It must have been an evolution of the game. But it was the Lebanese that played it over at the steel plant and wherever, and they used to play it down to the club, of course. And I remember when I was just a youngster, the men would come and visit our house, and they'd play Tarbish, you know, into the night, you know, and you could hear them pounding the table when they trumped you, your ARAs or whatever. So they played a lot of Tarbish in those days. And I was brought up, you know, knowing the game of Tarbish. I still play it, too, because I go down there on Thursday and Friday nights before the bingo game, and there's four of us or six of us that play, take turns in being partners down at the club before they start the bingo. So that's sort of fun. I really enjoy that. We play for a dollar a game, but you know, you never win or lose a lot. You might win $2, you might lose $2, you know, so it's really a fun game.
They're gonna shut the whole thing down. 700 men out of work. Another paper promise gone down. Oh, he's only 45, but he's still alive, 'cause he's never fought a fight he hasn't won. A man of steel says don't ever break until the job is done. Mary Ann wears 20 years of worry on her face like she never was young. She watched her husband work the hot steel, then she watched her son. And the streets of this town are cracked and blistered from all the weight they've had to bear. It ain't a town for weak hearts. The men of steel live there. Oh, the fires are fading in the plant tonight, but they're burning in his body and his mind. He said, they wanna melt my heart down, but it's not yet time.
Time.
steel mine down. Yesterday he saw his little girl at play. It's a game he played when he was nine. Paper and stone and scissors of steel. Paper winning every time.
The workers in the plant were at the mercy of the British Empire Steel Company in the early days. They'd work long shifts just to make enough to support their families. Even worse, they were often in debt to the company's store. The company owned everything, from the stores to the houses. The stores became known as the Pluck Me Stores, after many a steel worker or miner exclaimed, "They've plucked me," upon receiving their pay stub. The early 20th century was marked by labor strife in industrial Cape Breton. In 1923, the steelworkers attempted to unionize. The conflict between the company and the workers reached a head on July 1, 1923, a day that would become known as Bloody Sunday. Police from Halifax, sent at the company's request to keep the workers in line, attacked the striking workers and pursued them into the pier, attacking both strikers and pedestrians indiscriminately. In 1925, the miners went on strike. In response, the company cut off credit at their stores. As Marty explains, Jewish merchants stepped in to make sure their neighbors didn't starve.
Well, of course, I wasn't around in 25. I didn't come on the scene until 43. But I do recall my father and grandfather telling me when the strike in Glace Bay, people were pretty desperate. And I remember my grandfather churning and said, "Don't break into my wholesale. I'll give you everything you need on credit. When things get better, you'll pay me back." And I think a lot of other people that were in the food industry did the same. Probably the clothing industry, too. Jewish people, I've heard stories, have done that.
This didn't stop desperate people from raiding local stores for food. Stephen Nathanson is a historian who knows intimately the history of the Jewish people of the pier.
In 1925, like I said, they had the strikes, okay? So my grandfather lost, the warehouse was emptied at 16 Crossing. The next night they burned it down. Then they had to get the Jewish people out of town. They brought the army in and moved them into Sydney. When they came back, the store in 14 was still intact, but things were removed. There wasn't much left. My aunt Polly, who had been the oldest of the girls, wanted to go across the street to see her girlfriend. When she got across the street, she looked up, they were sitting in the kitchen, there was a ham hanging from the ceiling, big ham. Polly knew where that ham from because she hung it in a window in the store 3 days before. But they still stayed friends until they both died. What we realize is that they didn't do it because they didn't like Jews. They were hungry. And the company stores wouldn't feed them anymore. So they take whatever they can.
All in all, over 15 different ethnic groups would come to call Whitney Pier home. They blended and came together to create a unique identity, forged by geographic location from the rest of Sydney and from economic hardship. In 2014, the development of Whitney Pier was formally designated as a National Historic Event by the Historic Sites and Monument Board of Canada. The tight-knit nature of Whitney Pier, despite a declining population, still continues to this day. When St. Mary's Polish Church burnt down in 2014, the pier rallied around the congregation.
The story of the church is really, it's really near and dear to me and to everyone in the community. As you know, we went through a series of crises and I think came out a little stronger each time, a small but positive and generous, hospitable, resilient community. The most dramatic crisis, of course, was the fire that destroyed the church in 2014. It unfortunately happened when roofing contractors were working on a renovation. And thanks to the love and support of the broader community, for which we're ever grateful, the church has been rebuilt, and it's serving the community, not just the Polish community. For example, working with our friends in other churches and in the mosque and the pier, we started the Whitney Pier Community Kitchen, which offers free meals or donate what you can from the new space, from part of the rebuilt space. Many of the items and artifacts are connected with other faith communities and have a rich story. So even though everything was lost in the fire and will never replace the incredible pieces of art and the material culture that was reflected in the historic church, we're certainly telling the stories proudly of the items that have been contributed to us. For example, the high altar in the rebuilt church comes from a place called Wisła, Manitoba, and the first pastor of St. Mary's Polish Church, Antoni Puczynski, was transferred in 1915 from here to Wisła, Manitoba, and there had been no contact between the two communities for 100 years. After the fire, we established contact, quickly made friends, and the community in Wisła raised some funds and sent a couple of parishioners on the road with a trailer and an old altar that had been in storage. It arrived here. Dennis and Diane Janczycki were the kind people who had transported it, so they lived with local families for a couple of weeks, and then our friends from Parks Canada and others helped us to restore the altar. So that when people enter the rebuilt church, they feel it's the same spirit of place, and I hope it continues like that for a long time.
Another aspect of Whitney Pier's culture is the roll-up-your-sleeves, get-her-done work ethic that is still a point of pride among those who call the pier home. When I asked Tom Urbaniak what the future holds for Cape Breton, he gave me an answer that, to me anyway, seemed uniquely of the pier.
The challenges can't be minimized. But the solution lies in what Moses Cody called being masters of our own destiny. We have to establish what I've referred to in articles as affirmative self-government. So that means some formal authority, more formal authority devolved to this region so that we can make our own decisions and gather up our own resources. But it also means sort of informal methods of self-government. So some of the efforts we see in some of the communities, like Bay It Forward or Northside Rising, or the amazing work that's being done in Gabarus, where my students have been very privileged to be a part, those are examples of informal self-government where people adopt and also use the Polish expression, the solidarity strategy. It's like we're taking matters into our own hands and we're organizing our own communities and we're going to try to act as if some of those barriers don't exist. Not that we're naive or that we're promoting some sort of false consciousness, but that we believe we have the wisdom and the capacity and limited resources, yes, but pool, those resources have power. So affirmative self-government is, I think, part of the recipe for the future prosperity of Cape Breton. The continuation of the multicultural reality, that is a is critical. That is, I think, one of our greatest assets. And that's where you find examples of affirmative self-government. So what we've been discussing in the context of the Polish community, but not just the Polish community, where organizations are formed, events are organized. This stuff is driving the local economy, where visitors are welcomed from outside, where we use our cultural assets to actually build international ties. So we've recently had the incredible experience of working with the Cape Breton Regional Municipality and other partners to set up the sister city relationship between Cape Breton Regional Municipality and Wałbrzych in Poland. So Wałbrzych is a city of 115,000, similar population size, formerly based on coal mining. It's a post-industrial city that has done some very creative work on revitalization. What an incredible partner. And we've involved students on both sides. So you may recall at the signing ceremony on January the 11th, which was done virtually by video conference, we had students on both sides taking a lead. And students have continued to communicate with each other, looking at, for example, joint park projects, like designing parks that reflect each other's communities. At CBU, we now have a memorandum of understanding with our counterpart university in Wałbrzych. So that's a commitment to work together, and one stage of that will be student exchanges, starting on a small scale, but then hopefully evolving over the years. So that wouldn't have been possible if we hadn't had the cultural asset, a vibrant cultural community, after all these generations still functioning.
Sydney Steel. The sparks, the slickers, fireflies, the molded metal glows. She'll find a way to kiss you, safety in numbers and solidarity. And Charlie McKinnon led the chorus, save our industry. Sparks as thick as fireflies, the molten metal glows. She'll find a way to kiss you, buddy, burning through your clothes. You love the work, you hate the work, you're back against the wheel. But I never dreamt they'd lock that gate down in Sydney Steel.
A special thanks to Father Albert Maroon, Father Roman Dusanowski, Tom Urbaniak, Marty Chernin, Stephen Nathanson, and Deacon Whitfield Best. In the next episode of The Story of Home, we'll learn about the role of religion in Cape Breton's life as we pay a visit to the Houses of the Holy.
Curating Cape Breton's Multicultural Mosaic, a dedication to diversity past and present, is a Coast 89.7 original production. We would like to thank the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Radio Meters program for its financial support of this series.